Greetings again, everyone. Welcome to all of our guests today. We see some new faces every now and then, which we're very happy to see. I didn't get a report on the number of calls we had today, but I understood the telephones were out, at least, if not all the time, part of the time. So that was...
They still took over 300.
Over 300. Well, at least we got some calls in. Hello to all of you along the line in the tape program. I think Mr. Dart mentioned last time that we're preaching to somewhere around 1,000 people or so every, or more than that, perhaps every Sabbath that we're up here. Pam Dewey had sent down there one of our ministerial families serving up in the area of the Great Lakes, and sent down a very voluminous report, all itemized, computerized, and compartmentalized and everything, of every single sermon and Bible study and festival sermon and everything that we have done in the last nearly 7 years. And it's all cross-indexed, and Ron and I were looking through it the other day and was just sort of overwhelmed by looking at the dozens and dozens of sermon titles, and it's all grouped according to subject, it's grouped according to date, it's grouped according to the alphabetic order of the title of the sermons, and a full notebook, you know, full of all of these tapes. And it makes us realize what this tape program is doing. Mr. Dart mentioned last time about the number of them that find their way around. He didn't mention the number of them that find their way around almost clandestinely. There is a kind of an underground or a black market in CGI tapes. They find their way into purses and tucked under people's arms and their inside pockets in worldwide church services, for example. And people wander out of there with a sermon and listen to it and then write to us and tell us that they're hearing more and they're getting more benefit out of the sermons that they're hearing from Tyler than they are where they go to church. All of which makes us feel like our efforts are for some good. The last few weeks I've seen two different television commercials featuring rabbits. I forget what they're trying to advertise. One of them, the rabbits, or a couple of them, big bunnies that appear in there, and they're clucking like chickens. And then the next one, there are a whole batch of little baby bunnies about that big, and they're very, very cute, and they're hopping around a basket of Easter eggs. And there must be two dozen of them, little bitty rabbits, and they're making little peeping noises, like peep, peep, you know, like little baby chickens. And I thought, now isn't this stupid? That everybody knows that rabbits don't lay eggs, and yet, because it is almost the time of Ishtar, that's the way they used to pronounce it in ancient Babylon, or Easter, which is coming up very shortly, in a very few weeks, they are once again decking out all of your five and dime stores with candy, chocolate-covered eggs, and Easter egg painting kits, and all of that, and all the little bunnies are visible on television. They even have some candies that are wrapped up that are available only till Easter. Now, when people talk chronology about the great events that take place in our lives and talk about when this and that happened, well, it was just before Christmas last year, you remember? Or somebody will say, well, it was just after Easter, like the ski slopes all closed just at or before Easter. And they're always talking about these great pagan holidays as being a major chronological event of the year, something that really marks the course of the year, something that is important in history. If you tell people that you observe the days of unleavened bread, do you realize that 90-some percent of the population of the United States would not know what in the world you're talking about? They have really never even heard of that expression before. Years ago, when I would come to Big Sandy, and we were observing the Feast of Tabernacles, various of the news media would come, maybe from Dallas, or even the fellow that used to work up there for a little paper in Big Sandy, or the Gladewater paper. And we would talk about the Festival of Tabernacles, and I would show them where it's mentioned in the Bible. And they would want to know, well, how many people are going to attend, and how long does it last, and what about this dietary business? I remember that about the second year we were there, all of the restaurants in the Gladewater, Gilmer, Pritchett, you know, Longview area that were really catering to Church of God people had decided that for the Feast of Tabernacles, they were going to lay in extra stocks of matzos. And so, you know, we'd been there in the spring during the days of unleavened bread, and so during the Feast of Tabernacles, they had matzos and rye crisp and hardtack in all the restaurants, all over the place. They couldn't figure it out. Invariably, when they would interview me, they would go back to their typewriter, and here would come an article in the newspaper, "The Radio Church of God is in Big Sandy once again to keep the Feast of the Tabernacle." Because you see, they'd come on the grounds and somebody would say, "There's the tabernacle, and we're going to have a feast, So obviously it was the Feast of the Tabernacle. But they didn't understand the expression, the Feast of Tabernacles. As a matter of fact, I think many people in the church don't understand that expression. It should be the Feast of Booths, or of temporary dwelling places, or little shanties, if the truth were known. Do you know that Almighty God called the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, which is a type of sin in the Bible, by first of all demanding of Pharaoh that he let them go for a specific purpose, which was to go into the wilderness to keep a festival and to sacrifice to him? There are a couple or three examples of that. We find one in Exodus, the 5th chapter, in verse 3, really even after the calling of Moses, when Moses began to drag his feet and say, well, he couldn't talk very well. And God said, well, then Aaron will be your mouthpiece or your spokesman. But in verse 3 of the 5th chapter, they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us, Moses and Aaron talking to Pharaoh, and saying, let us go, we pray thee, 3 days' journey into the desert, and sacrifice unto the Eternal our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with a sword. Interesting language. They were either going to keep the festival, or plagues were going to fall upon them. Several times that language was repeated. If you will look into this, you will find that this was even before the taskmasters began to say, go out and gather the straw for yourselves. So their hardship in Egypt was far from over, and already God was proposing what? An annual holy day, a sacrifice of the Passover, as it became to be known. In Exodus 8 and verse 8, and also verse 27, it says, I will let the people go that they may do sacrifice unto the Eternal, in verse 8. Of course, he changed his mind. Along came the swarm of flies and so on. And later on, after that, Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron, verse 25, and said, go and sacrifice to your God in the land. An argument ensued about whether or not they could just go do it right here. You can do it in the land of Goshen. Moses said, no, it is not fitting so to do, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Eternal our God. Good point. What was the abomination to the Egyptians? Cattle. The Egyptians were not shepherds. The Hyksos, who were people who came among them, who may have been Amorites or may have been early Israelites, were found in their monuments as being an abomination unto the Egyptians, because the Egyptians worshipped cows, as do the modern people of India, and they would depict cattle with their horns and a sort of a solar disk between the horns, and they did not eat animal flesh. They were looked upon as a symbol of wealth, but they wouldn't eat them. And so Moses deferred, and he said no, because we would be obviously sacrificing sheep, lambs, cattle, etc., which are an abomination to the Egyptians. We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Eternal our God as he shall command us. And Pharaoh said, I will let you go, that you may sacrifice to the Eternal your God in the wilderness, only you shall not go very far away. Entreat for me. And Moses said, behold, I will go out from you, I will entreat that the Eternal will cause these swarms of flies to depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people tomorrow. But let not Pharaoh deal deceitfully anymore in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Eternal. Again, verse 32, you know the story. Pharaoh hardened his heart, and again that happened. Exodus 10. Down in verse 8, Moses and Aaron were brought again to Pharaoh, and he said, go serve the Eternal your God. But who has to go? Who all has to go? How many can stay behind? Moses said, we will go with our young and with our old, with our sons and with our daughters, with our flocks and with our herds we will go, for we must hold a feast unto the Eternal. And again in verse 25, Moses said, you must give us sacrifices and burnt offerings, because Pharaoh was arguing, verse 24, all right, you can go, but let all your flocks and your herds stay here. So little by little, he tried to make a concession, but each time he dragged his feet, and then finally reneged on it at the last, until the final plague fell. But always Moses was saying that we may journey 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Eternal our God. Now, for many, many years, the Church of God has kept on the eve prior to the Day of Unleavened Bread, actually the first Day of Unleavened Bread, on sunset, the night to be much remembered as being the night on which Israel came out of Egypt. There had been an extra 24-hour period that was manufactured because of a simple misunderstanding of the expression at even. I've gone through that before. And harking back to the sermon tape catalog that I mentioned, any of you that would like a very thorough explanation of that, there's a full sermon that goes through it that we have on tape cassette that you could obtain. That isn't the purpose of this message today. But notice chapter 11, verse 2. Speak now, this is before the death angel came, before the Passover, in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor. Actually, the expression in Hebrew is take wages of, and every woman of her neighbor, jewels of silver and jewels of gold. And the Eternal gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. Now, actually, that was all done in advance. The argument that was put before thousands upon thousands of God's people in past years was that even at the beginning of the Passover, or at the beginning of the Exodus, I should say, they had still to go out and to borrow the jewels of the Egyptians and to spoil them, and then they left on the following night because it was assumed that instead of using the statement that they were not to go out of doors until after the death angel had passed, even though the death angel went through at about midnight, and they obviously were brought with great haste to the Pharaoh's court by about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and the Exodus began about 3 or 3:30 in the morning, if the truth were known, during that same nighttime period, it was assumed that the angel who had said, do not go outside until the death angel has passed, was saying you can't go out until dawn of the following morning. So for decades, the church designated a particular custom as being the night to be much remembered, and inserted a second 12 or 24-hour period that is absolutely unnecessary, and did not ever clear that up. I still don't think it's cleared up in the worldwide Church of God to this day. In chapter 12, the Eternal spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this is to be the first of the months of the year. You speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month, they take every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an household, for a whole family. If the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the people that were there. And they took a lamb that was without blemish, a male of the first year, out of the sheep or from the goats. Many people think it was always a lamb. It could have been a kid as well. They had that opportunity. They were to set it aside on the 10th and keep it until the 14th day of the same month. And the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at even or in the evening. And it has been mentioned, and I think Bullinger goes along with this, and some of the sources do, and that's where the error crept in. My margin says, quote, between the two evenings. Now, without arguing the point for an hour, let me just tell you right now, that merely means at any point from even to even, or any point from sunset to sunset. But the way it was understood many, many years ago and taught to the church was it means after sunset, before full dark. That's completely artificial and is not required by the text, and I'll show you an example of that in a few moments. They were to take of the blood and strike it on the side posts and the upper door posts of the houses, wherein they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs shall they eat it. They were not to eat it raw, or soaked, or sodden with water, or boiled, in other words, but roast, broiled, or roast, or barbecued, the head with the legs, and all the pertinence thereof. And you shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, and that which remains of it until the morning you shall burn with fire. And thus shall you eat it. Why? With your loins girded. Now when they girded their loins, they wore a great big leather belt, sometimes had pockets in it. And they wore like more or less a semi-skirt, a skirt that might come to the knees or a little below it. And when they wanted to run, they had to take that and wrap it around their legs so it looked like a sort of a, you know, a loose, blousy kind of a pair of tennis shorts. And gird it up and tuck it in that big leathern belt. That was girding their loins. Your shoes on your feet, because like the Japanese, they did not wear shoes in the houses in those days. And that was a custom that was still prevailing into the Roman society, clear down many, many years after Christ. It was a custom, even during the time of Christ, when they would walk into a house, they would take off their shoe gear, and they wore boots as well as sandals, and they would have their feet washed, and then they would go and slip on maybe a pair of open slipper-like footwear, or maybe go barefoot indoors so they didn't track the house full of dirt. So when they had their shoes on their feet inside the house, indoors, it was very unusual. and your staff in your hand. Now, people used a walking stick, like a cane or a staff, sometimes a combination stick for walking and for herding the cattle. You shall eat it in haste, in trepidation, in fear. It is the Eternal's Passover. Why do this if they're going to stay there all night? The death angel is going to come. Moses and Aaron are going to go see Pharaoh about 1:30 in the morning. All the next day, from 8 o'clock until 6 o'clock in the evening, the Israelites are going to be visiting among all the Egyptians' homes and gathering all the wages and the spoil that was coming to them for all the years of labor that they had given. Why are they going to stand there with their shoes on indoors, very unusual, with their loins girded up, which is just like getting on your tennis shorts and ready to go out and play, and the staff in their hand, unless they were getting ready to go? The entire feeling of this is something that was done in haste, something that was done urgently. I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and I will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. The word Passover merely means exemption. We're about to observe the exemption, or the exception, or the pass on by, or the skip over, or whatever term means the death angel doesn't stop here. It was merely a term that meant the death angel was going to visit every home where there was not blood on the doors and the lintels, but he would go on by or pass over. He would make an exception where the Israelites were indoors with the blood as a symbol of Christ's blood on the doorposts. The plague will not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. Now, so long as there are generations of Israelites, these were not Jews, because Jews were not even known at this time in that sense. The word Jew had never been invented. 2 Kings 16:6, the first place in the Bible where it was ever used as a kind of a slang term for Judah, but it had never even been invented yet. But these were all of the Israelites, and they were of the many, many tribes of Israel, 13 in all, if you count the two half-tribes of Joseph. And they were to keep it throughout their generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. I want to show you how people get confused about that. Many, many people now believe that they should eat 8 days of unleavened bread because they don't know how to count. So many people now eat unleavened bread for 8 days. Because then came that day of unleavened bread, which is called the Passover, because the Jews began eating unleavened bread with and on the Passover period. And so in the New Testament, when it says that, people say, oh, well, we want to be extra righteous. And I'm going to be talking about that in a moment and see what that attitude is and why people get into that spirit and attitude. So we want to be really on the safe side where God is concerned. So even though God says you must eat unleavened bread 7 days, we'll go God one better, and we'll show him how righteous we are, and we'll eat unleavened bread 8 days. Oh, why not 9? Why not 11? Why not just diet on hardtack and eat unleavened bread for the rest of your natural life? You can if you want to. And if you felt more righteous about it, I suppose it would do you some little bit of good, but I'm not really certain about that. But it's not required in the Word of God. Does it or doesn't it say here, am I going blind? 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. Now, Mr. Merle Palmer wrote me a letter recently, and I had actually preached along those lines several times in the past, but he mentioned a very important point that we tend to forget, and I want to relate that to you and give him the credit where the credit is due. We put leavening out of our homes, but we ingest unleavened bread. We eat unleavened bread. Unfortunately, the emphasis tends to be, and has been for many, many years, on putting out rather than imbibing or ingesting unleavened bread. How many times have I heard people get up at a pulpit in sermonettes or sermons and say, the days of unleavened bread picture putting sin out of our lives, until you just get tired of hearing it? Well, what that connotes to most people is that we Just like the housewife with the flashlight and the vacuum cleaner, busily searching the corners, and some of the incredible stories we've heard of people literally taking furniture apart. And we used to have in a college people that would literally seal doors in areas in the dormitory where there's not even having to do with the kitchen, but where people slept, where they would put a sign on it, "This is an uncontaminated room," you know, sealed, "Do not enter, this is an unleavened area." Nonsense. It had air in it, didn't it? And if it had air, then it had yeast spores, and yeast spores carry leavening. But they would actually seal them up with tape, and there was this busy search to get rid of all the leaven. And people would feel betrayed, you know. They would, maybe later on they're deciding to clean their car, and they'd take the seat out, and underneath is part of a crushed cookie that their kid had put down in the seat, and they thought, "Oh no, that was in my garage, and I actually drove to church in my car during the days of unleavened bread. So I've somehow been contaminated, and sin followed me into the parking lot." And they will make this concerted effort to get rid of sin. So for years and years, the emphasis has been on putting leaven out. And doesn't that connote to people that somehow we have got the responsibility to put sin out of our lives? That it really is something we can do? That we do it on our own strength? That we overcome? That we get rid of it? That we do whatever is required to put sin out? You know, that's an action that you accomplish. But can you really accomplish such an action? You really can't. You're absolutely helpless to put sin out of your life. You can't put those two terms together. You can't put sin anywhere. You can accept it, I suppose. In that sense, maybe you can put it into your life because you can embrace it, you can allow it, you can think it, you can do it. But you can't put it out of your life. Only Jesus Christ and His shed blood can do that. Only Christ as your high priest on a day-to-day basis can get sin out of your life. You can put leavening out of your home, and you can avoid ingesting additional leavening, which is far more important than if you happen to miss a crumb, even though you do make a concerted effort to put leavening out of your home. In the 16th chapter of Matthew, and look at what Jesus said, beginning with about verse 6 of Matthew 16, the famous chapter where Jesus said, "I will build my church." Jesus said to the disciples, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, It's because we have taken no bread." Which when Jesus perceived, he said, "Oh, you have little faith." And you know, it was interesting that Christ a lot of times often would try to get them to come to their own conclusion. He would, in a sense, allow them by just skillfully leading them to a conclusion to try to come to an understanding themselves. And so he sort of takes them a little afield here, and he said, "Why would you reason that way? You took up all these extra baskets of food. Why would you think I'm talking about food when obviously by a miracle food was produced? How is it you don't understand," verse 11, "that I didn't talk to you concerning bread?" He's not talking about bread. "That you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And what is the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? What was their doctrine? Let's go back to the 6th chapter of Matthew and get one little bit of a clue. Here in the Sermon on the Mount, Christ is talking about religious people. He's talking about the religious people of his day. Beginning in the 6th chapter and verse 1, "Take heed that you do not your righteousness, your spiritual deeds, your alms, before men, to be seen of them. Otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore when you do your alms, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets." And who were the hypocrites? They were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I find this hard to believe, but it's true, that they literally would have a trumpeter who would go before them to get someone's attention when they would go into the treasury in the temple, or they would do something along the street, such as giving an offering to a poor person, or perhaps helping a cripple or something like that, and the person would blow on the trumpet, and all the heads would turn, and the righteous Pharisee would then do his great spiritual, righteous deed, and everyone would be very, very happy. They would perhaps applaud. They would just be very terribly impressed about this great righteous deed they'd seen accomplished. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. That's all the reward they got. Whatever joy they got out of watching people watching them was their joy, their reward. But when you do alms, that is, Christian deeds, good deeds, let not your left hand know what your right hand does. Again, a metaphorical statement. It merely means do it in secret. Don't do it ostentatiously, or ostentatiously rather, or as a display, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father which sees in secret himself shall reward you openly. And when you pray, you shall not be as the hypocrites are. Again, who are the hypocrites? Pharisees and Sadducees. This is a part of their doctrine, a part of their practice, a part of what God calls leaven. For they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets. Now, I am always embarrassed to have to pray in public. I don't like to do it. I've never done it in about 30 solid years of radio and television broadcasting. I've never prayed on the air. I've never prayed on television. I don't like to do the opening and closing prayer. Hardly anyone does. Most of us are rather embarrassed by that. I know once in a great while I hear somebody that seems to get a kick out of it, and I wonder when he's going to stop. But that's only very rarely, and perhaps in the other church or somewhere else. But there are those that really do enjoy standing up in church at the synagogue to pray, standing in the synagogues and out on the street corner. Why? That they may be seen of men. Now, I'm going to propose something to you that hasn't been proposed before. I'm wondering to what extent, during the days of unleavened bread, when we're imbibing unleavened bread, we shouldn't look into the result of certain doctrines and certain practices in God's church, both in the past and in the present, and ask ourselves, to what extent could this thing of vanity, which is the epitome of leavening, because leavening is that which puffs up. Leavening swells and puffs. And of all things, leavening is likened more unto vanity and the type of ostentatiousness and the type of display of posturing of pride that goes with religious pride than anything else that is portrayed in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul zeroes in on that. Here, you don't see leaven likened to a lack of tithing, or staying home from church, or being someone who is argumentative, or someone who has a very bad temper. But leavening is always likened to vanity, that which swells and puffs and causes pride in people. That wouldn't be present in God's church today, would it? It couldn't ever affect anybody whose very life is consisting of having to stand before people in a pulpit. I mean, are there people who so get their kicks out of being up in front of other people and orchestrating ideas, who so enjoy the sound of their own voice, that they just really get high on themselves, so to speak, whenever they're up in front of other people? I think that may be an affliction that may possibly be suffered by some folks here and there. I looked through a couple of magazines recently. One was sent. Mr. Dart has been collecting, as you know, a number of magazines to look into some of the fundraising techniques of some of the modern Pharisees and Sadducees who are on the airwaves every Sunday. One of the magazines was by Oral Roberts. There must have been four or five pictures of Oral Roberts in that magazine, and I wondered why. Well, I didn't really. I know why. But every time that I saw a picture of Oral or his son, it was like this. You know, he had his hand stretched out. His mouth is wide open, but his hands are always out toward you like this. And he's posed like that in this magazine. About every third page, there's old Oral. Well, I turned one page, first time I'd ever seen his magazine in my life. And they'd taken a picture of his hand. And here was his hand, life size. Just like this, wonk, right against the page. You know, like he'd taken an ink pad, but they photographed his hand. You ought to take it to a palmist and find out about old Oral's past. But anyway, it said there, illogically, that if you would take your hand and put it on his hand. Now, you couldn't with your right hand, because your right hand would be where your little finger was, because they'd forgotten to turn it around. So you'd have to take your left hand and put it on his right hand. But it allowed us how, if you would press your hand on that piece of paper with ink on it, you would have a point of contact with Brother Oral, and some marvelous thing would happen to you. And here was his son Richard in the magazine. And guess what he was doing? He was standing like that with his mouth open and his hands out toward people. And I thought, now, what does all this mean? I looked through that, then I looked through this other magazine by, I forget whether that was James Robinson or who that magazine was from. Oh, Jimmy Swaggart. Yeah, yeah, it was the same type of presentation. Full color, beautifully done. I didn't add it all up. But if I had bought every album, every tape, every book, every record, if I'd have taken advantage of every offer in that Oral Roberts magazine, it would have cost me somewhere around $14,000 to $20,000, I imagine. I don't know, but it was just unbelievable, page after page of things for me to buy. $300, $200, $600, $900, $400, $40, $35, $20. You know, it sounded like an auction. You look at the thing, it's just page after page. And I had never laid eyes on it before in my life. First time I'd ever even seen the publication. But I looked at that, and at all the pictures, and it made me think a little bit. I got to thinking about banquets and dinners in somebody's honor. Or I get to thinking about pictures and accolades and people praising one another. And special television programs done, and sermons where one man gets up and just talks about how marvelous some other man is. And then I begin looking into the Bible and seeing what it says here in the Bible about what Jesus thought about people who love it. I mean, they love to pray standing in the synagogues. It doesn't make them uncomfortable. They're not embarrassed by it. They don't miss a word every now and then, kind of get excited and feel like they're being listened in on, and like they hope they do a good job and stumble over their words like most of us do. But no, they love it. Love to pray, standing in the synagogues, in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. When you pray, he said in verse 7, use not vain repetitions. Now here he's not talking about the Pharisees. Here he's talking about pagans. He's talking about people in India and Africa and people who repeat endless words, as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Now let's go to the 23rd chapter of the book of Matthew, which is the one place in the New Testament where Jesus Christ really went through with a fine-tooth comb the practices, the attitude, the approach of the Pharisees. Jesus spoke to the multitude and to the disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, and they did bid them to observe the days of unleavened bread, the feast of tabernacles, to bid them to observe tithing and God's law, that observe and do. But don't do after their works, for they say and they do not. Now there are a lot of dichotomies in the world. There are a lot of ironies, a lot of problems that you can see with religions. I began to observe that same type of thing a number of years ago. It would bother me very deeply, for example, if I knew that a fast was being called, and I knew the entire church was being urged to fast for the work. I don't find any example in the Bible of fasting for the work. I find examples in the Bible of fasting because we are in a desperate spiritual condition, fasting because of praying that a demon will be cast out of someone, when Christ said, this kind cometh not out but by fasting and prayer. Fasting when a great decision is about to be made. Fasting when a great trial is about to be faced, as Christ, before he faced Satan the devil. Fasting for your own spiritual condition, because you need to know that, I mean, you need to get closer to God. You know you need to be closer to God. But fasting to cause a certain thing to happen mechanically, like fasting to have money come in, I have never been able to find an example of it. I remember when people have done it, and that a great miracle has occurred, and actually the work was blessed. But I remember that in that occasion, everybody did it. But as the years went on, everybody didn't do it. I remember one time, and I don't want to go into detail or to reveal anything because I don't want to take anyone to task, but let's just say a leader in the church was calling a fast and was saying to the people that he was now on his third day of fasting, as I witnessed handfuls of cashew nuts, peanuts, and all sorts of assorted nuts and raisins and other things going down his throat. And it seemed to me that in his own mind, the idea is if you don't sit down to a formal dinner served by a household servant, and you're not eating three meals a day, you walk by the cereal box or the Twinkies box or whatever, and you just kind of take a handful of this and that, maybe drink some water, and you're eating a lot less, but just enough to keep the real hunger pangs away, that you're fasting. On that particular occasion, I confessed, I'm sorry, I did it. I didn't fast. The church was being told, the whole church is going to fast. I didn't have the faith to fast. I just didn't have the faith to fast. Because I knew that the one who'd called the fast wasn't fasting. Now, if I look into the Bible and I see examples of say and do not, that bothers me. It bothers me. I know of many, many examples where I am aware that there are those who impose certain restrictions on families having to do with medicine, but they themselves do not. I know of cases where people have died with peritonitis, which is when the appendix ruptures, where the minister who may be standing up in the pulpit preaching this type of thing to people, putting a kind of an unhealthy fear, even a terror, a suspicion in their minds and hearts against medical science, of even going to have a checkup or going to find out what is wrong with them or having a needed operation or something like that. I have never in my life been treated better by any group of human beings who showed more sympathy, empathy, tenderness toward me than when I was in Baylor Hospital over there. That doctor was a real professional. He knew exactly what he was doing. Look, you know, I got 99% of my right arm, and I would scream with pain if you touched it, shake my hand. A little over a year ago, before I went over there and did it. You know why my arm was that way for so many years? Because I was so righteous. I was so righteous back in 1954 when I had my pole vaulting accident and broke my arm that I said, not me. I'll never go to have an x-ray because x-rays have deadly rays and they go through your body and that's liable to hurt my body. My body was broken. I had broken a piece of bone loose rattling around in my elbow. But I'm not going to let any rays go through it because, you see, I'm righteous. The church says don't go to doctors, and one of, you know, doctors just make money off their x-rays. Well, I was able to stand up and talk about slaughterhouses and butchers and this word that we find out is a word which has to do with witchcraft, which is the actual root of pharmacy, which is pharmakeia and pharmakon, you know, and we knew that that actually was a word which means witchcraft and superstition and so on. And so we were able to put down these doctors. Well, I know of a man who still occupies a very high position in that church, or probably not as high as he would like, but high in one way, who had a very, I would think a very serious bit of surgery. I mean, if my eyeball were pulled out of its socket and were lying out here somewhere inside of my cheek or whatever, and they were working around in the eye, I would call that pretty hefty surgery. But anyway, surgery of that nature, but probably to this day would be death on people going to the hospitals. And I don't understand that double standard. It says, whatsoever they observe, they bid you observe, that is, observe and do, but their works, privately perhaps, even kept from people, because they say this, but they do something else. They bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all of their works they do to be seen of men. Well, then these are the same people we were reading about in the sixth chapter of Matthew over in the Sermon on the Mount, who love to stand in the corner of the street or love to stand in the church and to pray. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. They had a sort of a vestige that they wore, a priestly robe, and they went a little extra distance. They made it far more decorative than originally had been intended in the book of Leviticus. They loved the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues. I transferred a man who I loved dearly and was one of my best friends, who had a position quite high. He was actually a deputy chancellor of one of our colleges, because he resisted me on that scripture right there. Because I've been resisted before on that scripture in the boardroom of Ambassador College. Because I would go to the Feast of Tabernacles up here in Big Sandy or over in Jekyll Island or up in Squaw Valley, and over in one side, right up near the front, or in the very choicest seats, wherever they would be. In Squaw Valley, it might have been the booths in the back where you had a little kind of a private tiered booth area there, would be the minister's section. As the festival got bigger and bigger, the minister's section could be, you know, a couple hundred people. And it would be all of their families and children. It was always, almost always the noisiest section, where the most disobedient kids were oftentimes. But they would be right up there in the front. And I noticed that we had special lodges at the festival. One of the most expensive up here at the Festival of the Ozarks was Tamtara. And it was absolutely choice. It had all the fine facilities and so on. Well, that was the place where the ministers all stayed. I noticed that that happened practically at all the festival sites. The best lodge and the best seats were reserved for the ministers. Well, the idea seemed to be way back there that if somebody needed a miracle right quick, he was able to jump up and get to them quicker than anybody else. Somebody had to be healed real quick, or a demon had to be cast out. Well, it's better to have the minister sitting there where he can just get to them real quick. Is that why it was? But somehow, as the 50s progressed, and then the 60s came along, and the 70s tiresomely, went by, all of that was forgotten. So one day in the boardroom, with all the ministers present, and my father there, I asked, couldn't we knock off this custom of having a special place for all the ministers? You won't believe the static I got, the argument I got. And finally, I just got put down and told it's not going to work that way. It isn't going to happen. Well, one time I remember after a basketball game, I was unwinding with my friends. We were sitting around in the faculty locker room. I had quite a long discussion with the gentleman. And I was mentioning this same thing, and he began to disagree with me. I wasn't in a mood to be disagreed with. And I told him exactly what I felt about it, and we sort of crossed swords. Well, he didn't last too much longer after that, because I made up my mind right then and there that I simply wasn't going to take that particular argument from that particular human being. But I have felt that way in the past. I remember also so well where one of the heads of the overseas offices, who was in charge of quite a large number of people and what rather a large budget, came up with a statement when I said, I think ministers ought to save festival tithe. I don't think that we ought to have that expenditure. We're looking to try to cut down. And I said, the ministers all go to the festival free of charge. They don't save a dime. They have all expenses paid, and every year they get this big fat check in the mail, which gives them air or ground transportation. Then they stay in the finest lodge free. Their meals are all put on a credit card free. All expenses paid, vacation, and the work is in trouble, and we're asking people to sacrifice and so on and so on. Why couldn't the ministry this year save festival tithe? I was told by this gentleman who was in charge of a very important segment of the work, well, if I did that, I couldn't come to the feast. Oh, I get it. But you see, when people would come to the ministry and say, well, I can't afford to save festival tithe, they'll say, you can't afford not to. You know, you must come to the feast no matter what, because that is the most important thing in the spiritual year, and if you didn't come, you would die in the vine, and on and on and on. There are no excuses. Now, have there ever been examples in your life where you have run into situations like this where you thought there were burdens that were being placed, where the people who put them there weren't having to carry the burdens themselves? That's what the Bible is really talking about here. And it's leavening. It is the leaven that is supposed to be put out of God's church. It isn't supposed to be there. They love the uppermost rooms at festivals and chief seats in the synagogues. I have always tried to sit in the back. Now, maybe some people think that's the chief seat because it's closest to the coffee pot. I don't know. I don't look at it that way. I'd be happy to sit over there in the closet next time if you feel I should. But when I'm sitting, waiting to speak, I don't like to sit in the front. I never have. I'm not comfortable in the front. Most people aren't. They tend to sit. There's always a bunch of empty seats up near the front if we don't have a full crowd. And I share in that. I like to sit in the rear. But many people just love to sit in the chief seats right up in the front. And greetings in the markets to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi, which is merely a term, teacher or master. But be ye not called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and you're all brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your Father which is in heaven. So whenever you see people who are revered as sort of having a father image, or are called the father of us all in the gospel, be careful. The Catholic Church, of course, refers to their priests as fathers. The Jews, as rabbi. It's almost like they have to look into the Bible to see exactly what God says don't do, and then do it. Actually, the term rabbi should never be used, but the Jewish religion uses it in contravention to Christ's command. But they do not accept Christ anyway. Neither be ye called master, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. Now, the way that is turned around oftentimes is that they are being served because the individual who is being waited on hand and foot, who is being, you know, is having his lawn mowed and his car washed and his briefcase held for him and his car parked in a particular place and his children babysat and has a special place and has a fat check to go to the feast on and all the rest of it, is able to serve you better because you've made his task easier for him. You understand? That seems to be the reasoning. Because he's serving you, how? Preaching to you. That's the way he serves you. And in most cases, unfortunately, it's the only way he serves you. Whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. You neither go in yourselves, neither do you allow them that are entering, that are of that spirit and attitude, to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore you shall receive the greater damnation, condemnation, or judgment. Now that has never happened, has it? Have widows' houses been actually devoured by people who have reached right down into the pocketbooks of poor widow ladies on fixed incomes and on welfare and have just tried to, you know, coerce the last farthing out of them by emergency letters and all sorts of scare tactics and getting them to even go out and mortgage whatever they've got to try to send money to the work? You look at all of this, you read it, and you read of what Christ says about it. He calls them hypocrites over and over and over again, blind guides, generation of vipers. I'll skip along and not read every bit of it. He says in verse 25, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you make clean the outside of the cup and the platter. Oh, they were washing away like a bunch of otters or beaver, just scrubbing away all the time on the pots and pans and vessels. But within, they are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also, talking, of course, metaphorically again about their hearts and their lives. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you're like a beautiful, whited tomb. Now, to me, a tomb is not beautiful. I go by and I kind of shudder. I don't like tombs, no matter how decorative they are, the materials of which they are made, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but within are full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. About a half-decayed body that has been in there about 30 or 40 years, heavily embalmed, that looks as shriveled up as one of the Pharaoh's mummies in a sarcophagus in Cairo, is not pleasant. And that is what is in the ground right across the street, rows and rows and rows of them, a huge crowd of them. If they'd all stand up and cheer right now, it would deafen you, right across the street. And it might look beautiful, nice lawns, not any raised sepulchres over there, but if you could raise them up, they're beautiful when they are there and they're shopped for and bought by the loved ones who are going to bury someone, and then flowers are put all around them and so on. But he said, even so, you're like that. You're like a sarcophagus, you Pharisees. You're like a casket. You outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within are full of hypocrisy and sin. Sin. They were filled with sin. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous and say, and as I've said, I never understood this until very recently, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore, ye be witnesses unto yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. Filled you up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you generation of vipers, how can you escape the damnation or the condemnation of hell fire? And that's what Jesus thought of the Pharisees. There are many examples in the Bible. Let's go to 2 Peter 2 and verse 18 for one of them, of that type of activity. 2 Peter 2 and verse 18. I'll read a couple of verses to set the pattern for this. There were false prophets, verse 2, 1 rather, of chapter 2, among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privately shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you. Now, you know, I jokingly refer to the Sunday morning comedy hour. You can get up and watch it tomorrow if you want to and see a little bit of it. It isn't for me to stand here in this pulpit and to attack those men. God will judge them. That's His business and not mine. But as my private opinion expressed before my God in my own heart, I just cannot believe that very many of them that I see are sincere. I honestly think many of them know better. I have seen examples of where people can become so completely self-deceived that even in regard to money, even in regard to writing letters or in giving very powerful sermons or speeches to people where they can actually become so motivated they really feel righteous in doing so, where the whole thing is unrighteous from start to stop, from start to finish, and is even a little bit maybe dishonest. It's certainly unjust, because if there are a few who are living very, very high on the hog at the expense of many who are being made, as it says here, merchandise of, and they are exploiting the flock, then to me that is the height of hypocrisy and is exactly what Christ condemned. And I have seen examples of it. They, through covetousness, with feigned words, make merchandise of you. So the motive is evil, the words are pretended, and the outcome is exploiting the flock through feigned words. I said to turn to verse 18. Here it is talking again about these same people, saying that they are like wells without water, clouds that are carried with the tempest, to whom the mist of darkness is reserved forever. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them, who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same is he brought in bondage. I preached my very last sermon in the Worldwide Church of God just about at the top of my lungs. Somebody sent a copy of that tape, I think, to Mr. Dart not too long ago. I was up in Rochester, New York. That was either the last or the next to the last, and the other one was just like it, was up in Milwaukee. And I was away from Pasadena. And I knew at that time that there were, as I said, too many leaks, maybe 40-some leaks, and I was like Peter in the dike with only two thumbs, and there were about 40 holes. I had discovered, although a little later on, that a man had been busily embezzling somewhere around one-third of a million of God's money. I also knew that salaries were on the order of $220,000 a year. I knew that a huge home was being actually taken and was being the deed put in somebody's pocket, that he was going to sell that and get the money from it, and on and on and on. I won't go back into that now because it's an obnoxious story to me. But I remember preaching at the top of my lungs that I thought it was absolutely an abomination for a minister to become wealthy for working in the ministry. That I just thought that a minister should not become a multi-millionaire, you know, working in the ministry to preach the gospel, and should end up becoming a multi-millionaire. I found out later that that tape made it back to headquarters in Pasadena and was just one more nail in my coffin. But it was unfortunate because Mr. Dave Pack came to me. My father had called him and ordered him to tape record me and not to tell me about it. But Dave Pack told me about it. So that shows the kind of loyalty he had to my father then. Now, maybe he's got better loyalty now, I don't know. But he defied my father then. And in one way, I guess then, I was sort of happy about it. Maybe I should have rebuked him and said, well, Dave, you shouldn't have told me that. But thanks a lot. You know, anyway, he came to and said, by the way, your dad called me last night secretly and told me to tape record your sermon and send him a tape. And so on. I said, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. But, as I said, that was just another nail in my coffin. Over in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the Apostle Paul shows that just a little bit of sin ruins the entire picture. Here is that scripture where it talks about vanity and being puffed up. You are puffed up, verse 2, and have not rather mourned that he that has done this deed, a case of adultery that was happening inside the congregation, but this was probably incest, and it might have involved even one's own mother, or it might have been a stepmother, and some of them disagree on that, might be taken away from among you, as verily absent in body, but present in spirit, I have judged already, as though I were present, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 3, concerning him that has so done this deed. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together, and my spirit with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, to deliver such an one unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Your vanity, your boasting, your glorying is not good. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? He called that a little leaven, and yet it was a great and a very gross sin. And it's the same old analogy we've used, that one rotten apple spoils the whole box, or a rotten orange, or whatever you want to say, and that unless you get it out of the box, the entire box is going to be spoiled. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened. And what was he talking about? Was he talking about individual people's lives purging little bits and pieces of wrong practices and wrong habits out of their private lives? Or wasn't he talking about cleansing, purging the church? He was talking about the latter. He was talking about leavening in a local congregation. And I tend to think that we miss some of the point of the Days of Unleavened Bread, which we're about to begin here in a few more weeks, beginning on about the 5th, which is the Passover of the next month. Because we tend to think about putting sin out of our private lives, when perhaps we ought to take a look at the structure of the church, at all of us collectively, at the church as a whole together. He said, your glorying is not good. Know you not that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened, which absolutely proves that this letter was written or was read during the Days of Unleavened Bread. Otherwise, it's completely and opposite. He is saying that they were observing the Days of Unleavened Bread while this was being read. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us, therefore, saying to Gentile Christians, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. The feast that we are about to keep is a feast that shows the putting out of leavening, that's true. But only Jesus Christ of Nazareth can do that. We cannot do that ourselves. Christ is able to do it by the power of His Spirit, by His shed blood, by interceding, intervening for us on a day-to-day level as our high priest. I think oftentimes the emphasis has been that if we can put sin out of our lives, and we make our effort to putting leavening out of our homes and our closets and cupboards, and the wives vacuum and even look behind the sofas and all of that, they wouldn't feel good if they didn't make some sort of an effort to clean their houses up of leaven. But sometimes I think some of the most obvious leavening can be right inside of us. I know of cases where great swelling words of vanity are being spoken, where in some cases people are rather insufferable and their own congregations have to suffer through it. Some cases there are that exist in God's church today where they say do and don't do themselves. But I've said for years that just one little cut across the face of the Mona Lisa would ruin the entire painting. That, you know, the little kid down here I told you about perhaps one time, there was a great big beautiful Porsche, well, it's not big, parked there, and what are they worth, $50,000 or something? And some teenager had gone by there with a key, and it just absolutely just raked a great big huge stripe all across the side of that gorgeous automobile. And I guess he thought, well, here's somebody that's got a tremendous amount of money, and I just can't stand them to have that money and see that beautiful car, so I'll just spoil the car. Well, it did. It just spoiled the car. I see Corvettes and other cars parked crossways all the time, parked across the line, taking up two parking places. You know why they do that? So your doors won't whack into the side of them and ruin the beauty of the automobile because they're afraid of them. It only takes a tiny dent in the fender of a new car to make it look kind of ugly. You know that one little 22 short could absolutely cause a great sophisticated jet airplane not to be able to fly? Just one little tiny hole in the pressurized hull of a jet aircraft, and it would be a terrible disaster if it should occur. A sin is supposed to be missing the mark. And a lot of times we think it is only a very little thing. But it isn't in God's sight. It's a very, very big thing. And apparently the way Christ looked at the Pharisees, one of the greatest sins of all is the sin of pride, the sin of vanity, but especially the sin of spiritual pride and spiritual vanity as evidenced by religious men. Now, see if I'm not right. Tomorrow morning, if you like to do that just for the fun of it, I can't stand it. I'll be out in the golf course. You go ahead. You might tune in to the Sunday morning comedy hour and see if you can't find a little bit of what Christ was talking about, of those who love to stand up there in front of people and really are on sort of a high while they're speaking with all of these feigned words and making merchandise of their audiences.